the Harbor Alley, which has 50 years, clearly connected to what's happening in that ecological hotspot over there. So at first I thought I'd tell you about just some of the work we've got going on and that sort of thing, and then I'll get into Harbor Island. And what you've been watching here in this loop, we've worked closely with the boatmen and artificial reefs and conversion oil and gas platform artificial reefs, and that's what it really looks like down there in terms of these rigs to reefs and cutoff reefs. But anyway, so our goal at the Sport Fish Center is to have sustainable fisheries. Fisheries are renewable on our time scale if we manage them properly. And so we work on fish, of course, red snapper, which pretty much drives our program, to the pelagics, the tiny little fish that we care about around Harbor Island that you need a microscope to see some of the time, all the way up to apex predators, but also habitat, because if you don't have habitat, and then you don't have access to that habitat, you break that sustainability chain, and that's what we feel is really critical. So our Sport Fish Center, through science and also what we call engagement, which is what we're doing tonight and many other things, are engaging the public to understand and have a scientific grasp and understanding of some of the issues facing our region. So anyway, with that, you know, why do we care about sport fisheries and why do we have a center dedicated to sport fish? And why are we all concerned about what impacts might happen with the Harbor Island? You're talking about 4.5 million jobs revolving around sport fishing. There's 220 million recreational anglers across the United States. That's nearly $40 billion worth of activity that's generated on an annual basis. When you look at the gross economic input and the hotels and the fuel and the gasoline and all that sort of thing and restaurants, you're looking at $731 million. To put that in a broad perspective, activities revolving around recreational fishing, the things that drive our communities here, are 2.2% of the U.S. GDP, and that's a big number. So the key to that, obviously, is you can't affect that sustainability. Big fish tend to take care of themselves if we manage them properly, and of course that's another story. But if the babies aren't coming in, that replenishment or that sustainability can be compromised. And that's why we're very concerned on the Harbor Island issue. But when we go to manage fisheries, probably the biggest problem we have, and this is a perfect case study, is that we often are hindered, or we don't have the lack of the scientific data that we need to make the most informed decisions. And that's where we come out from the Sport Fish Center, is giving managers and decision makers the scientific tools they need to make the most informed decisions. Obviously, as a scientist and working at a university and academic institution, we don't necessarily advocate. We provide the science. We can interpret that science and what it means and what impacts might be. But then it's up to groups like the boatmen and others to take that information and use it in terms of creating sound policy and sound environmental management. But some of the projects we revolve around, just briefly, many of you have been involved in this. We have very big citizen science programs where every day people can be involved in the scientific data collection process, from helping tag our fish, collect our fish, report. It has been a really fun and also a very scientifically powerful tool. One of these we have is called the TexAN, and it stands for the Texas Acoustic Array Network. And we're tagging all sorts of fish, including red snapper, with these little tags. I'll pass them around. And I see Dr. Ehrsman from UT in the back here. He's also doing very similar work. We have technology in our hands now that we can really study what's happening with fish. We can know when fish are moving in and out of that inlet. We can know when they're spawning in that inlet, which is Dr. Ehrsman's expertise. And very, very unique information. And so we implant, wherever you see a little dot, we've got listening stations, and we have fish swimming around so we can understand tidal inlets and different things like that. That's just one example. To give you a real concrete example, we've had that fish, spotted sea trout, obviously speckled trout. Many people think they don't survive catch and release, which isn't true. 90% survive, so that's a positive. But most people think they don't move. This fish in 66 days moved 109 miles. And that's just one tiny example of how we're making scientific discoveries. We see fish moving in and out of these tidal inlets, which I'll tell you about in a little while, and all kind of other unique stuff and tools we have in our hands. Many of you have heard me talk here in the past about artificial reefs, and of course we are very concerned when all the oil and gas platforms that develop entire ecological communities were being removed at an alarming rate. The good news is those have been put back into the ecosystem, or at least converted to rigs to reef for the most part, so there's still plenty of places to fish, but we're out often sampling those and doing a variety of things. Where most of you have been engaged with the boatman's group is this problem of the fishery that we have of red snapper. But it's getting better. We moved to regional management with little pickups this year with the season, but it's getting better and better. Our group was funded with a $12 million study to count how many snapper in the Gulf of Mexico. Believe me, you would think a fishery of that iconic nature, we know how many there are to manage, but we don't. So we're working with 11 different institutions, over 20 investigators to get at that number. All of you have helped out. Too many of you caught our tagged fish this year. So that's what they look like over there. That's a $500 fish with two tags, but the single tag fish are worth about $250. And this mark and recapture is a way we can also estimate their population size. But we've had a phenomenal return rate, which also shows, believe it or not, even on a deep water fish like this, they can survive catch and release. I'll tell you about that in just a second. But here's what some of that work looks like. This is a This is from an ROV, or a remotely operated vehicle. And that's part of my cruise out on a 60-day, what we call a research cruise right now. In fact, they're on Baker Bank tonight, in fact. Running our RV and counting up the snapper to determine how many they are. This iconic fishery drives the Port Aransas community. If you haven't noticed how many offshore vessels were here this summer, it's because of this fishery and this recovering population of what's going on. And I'll tell you about a little more fun stuff, and then we'll move on to what I know you want to hear about tonight. The other work we do with everyday people and everyday fishermen have to do with catch and release. In many fisheries, we release more fish than we retain. So by releasing those and conserving that resource to catch and release, we can improve or maintain those fisheries. And many people often wonder, and we have iSnapper apps and other things that help us gauge that recreational and discard catch. But we've got this unique device I want to tell everyone about, and anybody fishing for deep water offshore fish should be using it. And I'll show it here in just a second, and then I'll show it to you in action. But it's called a sequelizer. And many of you know when you bring a snapper up from deep water, they have the bends just like a diver would get. Their stomachs are coming out of their mouth. Their eyes are typically kind of bugging out. Air is hissing out of their scales. That fish can't resubmerge if you're required to descend to release that. But if you used to vent them and stick a needle in it, which actually works really well if you stick it in the right place, but putting a big needle in a fish can be problematic. So we've been working with a team with these devices called sequelizers. If you know what a boga grip is, it's very similar. You click it on the fish's lip, you dial in the depth you want it to open up, you send the fish back down, and these are reusable, so you have a rod with a heavy weight, you send it back down to the depth you dialed in, and it pops open and releases the fish at depth. What we've discovered is that with those tags, not tracking the fish, but they also tell us if the fish is alive or dead, you convert a dead fish that's almost 100% mortality to a fish that's almost 100% survivorship. So this year we tagged 4,000 snapper throughout the Gulf for our tagging study. We're getting 20, I budgeted 10%. I'm blowing my budget right now because we're getting 20% of the fish back. And we released every single one of them with the sequelizer. So if you have to wonder whether it works, the question is answered there. But I'll pass these around for $50, which is a minor amount for an offshore fishing trip. And they're reusable. We heavily encourage. If you want to see how that works, I'll show you real quick. Move on. If you look at this bottom right, we keep GoPro in business. But this is like looking at the same fish in four directions. If you watch the bottom one, of course we caught it. We've watched them with cameras and electronic tags to monitor their survival. I've sped it up a little bit for you. The top one there, you can see he's being recompressed, the fish, and there's the artificial cutoff rig. And you'll see here where I slowed it down, it will pop open. Wow. And release that fish at depth, and that would have been a dead fish. But those are converted into a live fish. So. Cool. Anyway, the last bit of that revolves around our program that we call Release Sense. And this is a partnership with Shimano and CCA, and the whole idea is release makes sense, so it's Release Sense. And we're engaging the angling public because many are hungry for information that, I mean, we certainly, I fillet my share of fish every year. There's nothing wrong with, you know, having the experience of eating your fresh catch. I mean, that's certainly the main reason we fish. But there's a lot of people that would like to release more fish from a conservation standpoint, but they don't have the scientific tools to do that. And that's what our Release This program is about. And we're really trying to make anglers leaders in conservation and leaders of their sport. And you can read more about that at releasethis.org. But the tagging program, the sequelizers, and a bunch of inshore and offshore stuff is on there if you're interested on how to keep fish alive. And the last bit of advertisement, since we're on the hills of Shark Week, is our shark program, because everybody always asks me about that, whether I talk about it or not. So I thought I'd just put a couple slides in here. And we've done a heck of a job. You know, most people think sharks, and maybe I should tell you first, you know, sharks have become our scientific instrumentation with cameras, satellite tags, and all kind of cool stuff to monitor what's going on with them, which, funny enough, moving in and out of Aransas Pass. But most people think of sharks something like that. That was from our, you might have seen Monster Mako, which a lot of local celebrities, which was filmed just out of here, that's from Monster Mako. But it's pretty amazing to work with these animals, particularly the Makos that are leaping from the waters, you know, higher than the roof of this building and that kind of thing. And this is a picture of a fisherman's work, the largest Mako ever caught in the Gulf of Mexico. And what we're doing is we're putting satellite tags. Well, first I should probably tell you, we catch them by hand. We catch them, but that's the hook and this is the line. Most people probably fish with 20-pound test as a leader. We fish with 2,220-pound test because we pull them in as fast as we can. We don't want them to die, and sharks are very important to the ecosystem. You want to see that. And so once we get them, then we attach our instrumentation. This is an example of a shark fin, obviously. And every time that fin clears the surface of the water, it relays us a real-time position anywhere on the planet that shark has been. So I thought I might show you some of the fish that were caught just outside of the inlet here and where they are today. And so obviously, this isn't the shark talk, but sharks are key components of the ecosystem. We've done a real good job of removing too many sharks and too many big sharks. And so we're understanding what they do in the Gulf of Mexico by this technology. But I want to talk about Harbor Island. But let me just tell you what's happening here. This was Harvey Weil, a shark that we caught. You might know Chuck Weil of Corpus Christi, and it was named after his grandson. Just outside of Port Aransas, that fish was caught and made it to the Caribbean and back three times. He spends the winters up here near Port Aransas and the summers deep down in the Caribbean, and makes that trek back and forth, probably breeding here in the Gulf of Mexico and pupping down in the Caribbean. Pico's an active one, and by the way, at our shark tracker, you can follow these on your phone in real time. You know, it's another one of our engagement pieces with the public. Pico, on the other hand, goes up to the East Coast. Same story, he's here in the wintertime, but right now he's pinging right off of the Maryland area right now, if you want to follow Pico. So pretty cool, kind of really interesting stuff. And if anyone wants to talk about that, you know, feel free to reach out to me. But that's a little bit of some of the activities that we have going on at the Sport Fish Center. I'll go ahead and pass it out to Tag, and we'll actually see what that looks like in those electronics. It's pretty quite amazing that we can track fish from our smartphones anywhere that they go in the world. But one of the other less charismatic things we do is study fish that are tiny and microscopic. But it's probably one of the most important things we do, because if you don't have that supply chain of babies that I mentioned earlier, you're not going to have the sustainability for all these big fish. And one of the critical things that fish need is access to their nurseries. And that primarily occurs through tidal inlets like the Aransas Pass. The other closest ones we have to us would have been Cedar Bayou. I'll talk about that in a minute. But near Port O'Connor and Pascavallo, and then Packery Channel, and of course down in Brownsville, Louisiana. So there's not many. These fish have to get through the inlet as microscopic larvae or very early juveniles to reach their nursery habitat. So as you might imagine, this connectivity between the Gulf of Mexico and their nursery areas is critical. So I'll tell you the general life history of it so you'll understand that in just a minute. But whether you're talking about crustaceans like shrimp or crabs or redfish or flounder, they all do it. And we've spent well over the last 20 years. I know Scott Holt and Joan, who are now retired, have spent careers studying these fish in the tidal inlets, particularly larval fish. We study the fish just as they get about pinky nail size and a little bit bigger. But the critical component here is access to their nursery habitat, which in this area is seagrass. So they're wanting to get in that because that's their grocery store, that's their homes, and without that, they don't survive. And so there are things like marsh, seagrass, and even non-vegetated bottom. And we spend a lot of time right around Harbor Island, and maybe you've seen us if you're out, pulling small nets, trying to quantify how many fish are in our estuarine nursery habitats. And to give you an idea, in a square yard, but we measured in meters, in a square meter of habitat of seagrass during peak red drum recruitment, let's say right in front of the Lydian Lighthouse, you could have as many as 20 little redfish this big. Of course, they go away and grow up and move and spread out, but as those pulses are coming in, that's some of the highest we've seen really right in that area there. And that's us pulling it right on the beach right near there. So what happens, if you looked at the Gulf of Mexico, the adult, believe it or not, the big redfish you catch in the bay are juveniles. When they reach about 28 inches, they become mature, or rough maybe 26, but by 28, 30, they're almost all mature, and they move out through the tidal inlets. We put those trackers in them and follow them right out of the tidal inlets, and they live the rest of their lives in the Gulf of Mexico as the spawning stock. Of course, they're out there spawning. And so they're creating small eggs and larvae, and the bigger juveniles get a little bigger, and the larvae and juveniles come in through tidal inlets. In this case, they're coming in through Cedar Bayou. And they populate the nursery habitats that are in those areas. The same thing happens right up here in the Aransas Inlet. In fact, Scott Holt for many years would put plankton nets right off the pier there and monitor that larval ingress, and we would partner with him and calculate how many larvae are coming in and how many does that translate into little fish, little pinky nail sized red drum, and then how many of those grow up to be adults. And so that's a really important process, obviously. And so what we've discovered and what you can see here is that's us planting a bigger fish, like a redfish, to look at the adult movements and a sampling for the little ones, that these inlets are what we call ecological hotspots. It's the only way for them to get to from their spawning grounds into their nursery habitats where they can grow up, complete the life cycle, and then join the spawning stocks. The same thing happens for what it's called estuarine dependence. You're dependent upon the estuary for a portion of your life cycle, so obviously you have to get back and forth. And so flounder, red drum, a whole variety of crustaceans do it, all the important shrimp and crab species. So this connection is really, really important. And so these areas are really important for the ecology of the species, and that's why we call them ecological hotspots. So what's really happening when you look at a little tiny red drum, so that red drum there's probably about 25 or 30 days old. It's just come into the estuary seeking the nursery habitat. Of course, what we want to see as a sport fish center and anglers is that. So that is a redfish that's probably about to join the spawning stock. It's reaching its mature age. But the question is, how did it go from that little individual into that adult, which is about 4 or 5 years, by the way, and the key thing is habitat. So the number one thing you've got to have is you can't degrade the habitat. In our area, the number one habitat is seagrass and marshes, but oyster reef, and as I mentioned, even that non-vegetated bottom can be very important to some species. Of course, the next thing, the habitat's no good if you can't access it, and I'm going to give you a perfect study of what happens when you start messing around with the tidal inlet here in just a second. And because Dr. Arisman is in the audience, and because he's just made some really unique scientific discoveries about spawning aggregations that are occurring at the jetties and right there in the inlet, and many anglers know that. For example, sheep's head are a good example that spawn there around the wintertime, and they're there because they're making young sheep's head, and they're aggregating there. Of course, we like it because it makes for easy catching and a large congregation of fish. So you've got to have the spawning in these ecological hotspots. It's got to provide the access to the habitats they need to support the big fish. And as I mentioned, the big fish, if we can manage them properly, which we do a reasonably well job of doing that, it's this other front-end side that we really have to take care of in terms of the habitat and access. And so to give you a case study, so as I mentioned earlier, one of the issues we always have as scientists, we don't have enough information that we need. I can tell you many of us are out there right now generating some key baseline data of what's happening in this tidal inlets in and around Harbor Island and in control areas. And so we had this really unique experiment we could conduct a few years ago with Cedar Bayou to give you an idea of what happened when you open and close a tidal inlet, or at least restrict the flow. And so that's Cedar Bayou. Many of you will know where it is, but it's off Mesquite Bay, just straight across from Rockport to our north. Traditionally, that inlet had been open and closed because we had a lot of fresh water coming into the system. All this pressure, called head pressure up north, forcing that fresh water out of the tidal inlets and keeping it open, and hurricanes would storms would keep it scoured. But that kind of went away with reductions in freshwater inflow, and that inlet closed up. People recognize the value of these inlets. And by the way, the small animals don't go very far from the tidal inlet. Those, we like to say all habitats aren't really created equal. It's those habitats right near the tidal inlets which are the most essential habitats, because these little red drum that would come in Aransas Pass would not get back in Mesquite Bay. It was way too far for them to get there. They would grow up and eventually move there, but as far as nursery habitat, it was very little value because it had no access to the Gulf of Mexico. Well, what happened through a great project with Aransas County, the CCA, and a variety of groups, they opened this bayou, and it was astonishing what happened up there. But what was more interesting is that we knew this was coming, and we had an opportunity to do a study called a before-after control impact, a BOCI. So we were able to study it before and after, and also in a control region, and then right in the impact region. That's one of the few ways you can really assign a cause and effect to some type of disturbance in an inlet, for example, or all kinds of things. And so we were up there for 2 years for it, and I know it's late, and of course I'm a professor, so you get somewhat of a lecture and a couple of graphs here, and I'll be wrapping up in a minute here, Brent, 30 minutes. But here's what happened. So it was open, it opened right in between the perfect timing of red drum. Red drum, by the way, are just about to start spawning. In a month, they'll be going full swing to about October. That's when it was open. As you can see up there, in our impact site, there was no red drum. By the way, our control sites right here in Aransas Harbor were loaded with little ones. So those fish were not making it there. Then all of a sudden it opened up right in the middle of the spawning. We didn't get the full pulse of fish coming in, but literally the next day it was open. We were up there collecting little bitty red drum. As you can see in 15 and 16, we saw the highest red drum ever recorded in our 20 years of sampling tidal inlets. So it was quite amazing. And then, as we all know, what happened shortly before 2017 ended was Hurricane Harvey. And I would have predicted, because that eye pretty much went right over Cedar Bayou, that you could have driven a VLCC through Cedar Bayou, but that wasn't the case. It was just far enough, unfortunately, to us here, that it pushed all of that sand in the bayou and closed it up. It trickled around for a little while there, but it never really flowed like you see in this picture here. It was right, of course, there was some redfish coming through there at the time because it was during the recruitment season, so we had a tiny pulse, just like in the beginning, and so far we haven't seen any red drum in there since. So the point is, of course, this is a natural effect, but if you mess with the tidal, if you open it and you have flow, you get fish, you close it or impact those larval access to those habitats, and you restrict the fish that are there because they don't get very far from the tidal inlet. So the point is, tidal inlets are key. The other thing in this, it isn't just delivery. We don't really scientifically know for sure what these fish chew on, but some think it's sound, that seagrasses make a certain sound in their habitats and they can detect that. There's a lot of evidence that it's fresher water cues coming from the estuary. The estuary is fresher than the open ocean. And so they can follow those plumes of fresh water, although they can't really swim, but they have a little bit of direction to go the way they need to go with the tides. But we don't know for sure. But the point is, if there's heavy turbulence, heavy dredging, changes in salinity, and by the way, larval fish are probably the most sensitive, or they are at that stage, they are the most sensitive of their life cycle to any detections, any changes in temperature and salinity and that sort of thing. So a lot of stuff is happening. And what happens in those inlets, the red drum are spawning at the mouth of the jetties and down the beach and maybe a little further out. Those larvae and young fish are bottlenecked through these inlets, and they really can't be disturbed. You don't obviously want them to hit a wall of salinity, for example, because those minor changes would be catastrophic for these pulses of fish that are coming through. And obviously, when you completely restrict the flow, you know, that's not a good thing. But there's other issues like resuspension of sediments and a whole host of things that can affect these small fish. And so that's a perfect case of what happens when you really can say, hey, I have a tidal inlet completely shut down. I have a tidal inlet completely open and then shut down again. Now, the other thing is you don't need a lot of flow. What we couldn't figure out until it hit me just the other day in a meeting with Scott Holt and some others talking about dredging the depth of this channel. Cedar Bayou doesn't move a lot of water. I mean, it's a lot of water, but it's nothing compared to the inlet out here. There's something called the bathtub effect. And as you dig channels deeper and deeper, the water just kind of sloshes around in the channel, and the real tidal prism and the tidal waters don't really get up and out into the flats and into the habitat. There's been a lot of modeling that has shown that. So you would think that the more water and the deeper you get, you're going to deliver a lot more supply of larvae and young juveniles, but typically that's not the case. And so several of us are working with mathematical modelers and ecological modelers that understand currents and oceanographer types, which we're biologists, to understand at what point do you get so deep that you really restrict the flow, or is more similar to what closing an inlet would be like. And we don't know that, and that's a big problem that we have, is we don't have all the scientific information to make those informed decisions, as I was talking about earlier. But I can tell you about some reports. There, the Parks and Wildlife and the General Land Office looked at desalination. And by the way, I should probably say that we have a huge water problem in the state of Texas, if you don't know it, and really globally. And we're not going to meet it by river flow and groundwater. Probably desal is the only answer to that. But so we've got to be looking at desal, but we've got to be looking at it in an environmentally friendly way, in an ecological way that is not going to impact some of the dynamics of the ecology in these hotspots. So we recognize that. And the same thing with oil and gas. I mean, you know, hello, we live in Texas. We have energy demands, and we need to move that petroleum, but there's ways to do it in a way that you don't affect your fisheries, and then there's ways that potentially harm them. And so that's where sort of the scientific dividing line occurs for me. But the Parks and Wildlife and CLO recognize the need for this fresh water, because heck, if we could offset some of the river flow and have all that fresh water flowing to the estuaries, that's the lifeblood of what's driving the productivity in our estuaries. We want that fresh water coming in. And if we could offset that with desalination, that would be a good thing. But we also don't want to have all these unintended consequences of putting it in the wrong place. And so they did this study. What you see on this map are expedited areas to put intake and discharge of desal. And the reason I put this up here is if you notice, there's a lot of white patches. Should have brought my pointer. There's a white patch here, 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 and up there. And of course, you know, you don't have to be a scientist to figure out why are there not green spots near those, in those white patches. It's because that's right outside of every one of the tidal inlets. Because even intuitively, people are recognizing that, well, desal wouldn't be so bad if you don't put it right in the area where you're having all of this ecological activity going on. And so, anyway, that was a report that was done about a year ago. So I wanted to give some what I consider scientific advice in best ways that scientifically I think we could approach desalination, because after all, we're going to have to do something about fresh water. And there are options. One is infiltration galleries, whether it's inshore or offshore, where imagine a giant French drain. You run a pipe down into the drain and you intake the water down as it percolates down through the drain or the infiltration gallery. It's such a low speed at the top that you're not entraining or pinching any type of marine life. And the reverse happens when, in a different location, obviously, you inject the discharge in the high brine and it percolates back up. And by the time it's reached the surface of the seafloor, it's back to ambient salinity. So that's one way. Japan's kind of a leader in these infiltration galleries. Obviously, it's a very different system, but they've been very successful at using that technology in terms of desal. Now, what about some others? So obviously, a lot of things going on. The thing happened almost immediately, probably, is the desal permit going on. So that would be a way to meet freshwater needs and have the least environmental impact. And believe me, not everything's perfect. Everything has some impact, but this has some of the least, especially if you choose the right areas to put these infiltration galleries. And so what about VLCCs? Well, we have somewhat of an answer there too. Again, there's pros and cons, but the best thing, in my opinion, is if you're bringing, the main problem in my scientific opinion of VLCCs is the dredging that will need to take, the continual dredging that will need to take place to bring those ships in, and then you have, and you guys all know the story of all the other issues that could be associated with bringing that type of ship into the estuary. But there are offshore terminals that have been used very successfully in many, many places, the closest one being Louisiana, where you bring the ships in the depth that they need to an offshore terminal where they can load and unload. And there's a variety, there's still issues with that. So, I mean, it's not a perfect situation, but you relieve some of the environmental concerns that I think most scientists would have of bringing those into the estuary in such these sensitive ecosystems that are there. So, two that I know of are proposed are one out near the ship anchorage, and then one, of course, going off of Padre Island Seashore, at least the two that I know are proposed, but I know there's a bunch of others that are coming and going. But the point is, there are options to that versus really definitely impacting a tidal inlet. So I guess what are the real takeaways from my presentation today is that we've got to meet the energy and water demands. I mean, if we want to be realistic as scientists, I mean, we being preservationist says, let's don't do anything, I guess. But we do have water needs, and we do need to meet the energy demands. But we've got the means and technology to do that. Obviously, it's just more costly, and that's the big problem. But we have an opportunity to be leaders in the state and in the world, for sure in the United States, of this is how you can meet freshwater needs in an ecologically sustainable way, and this is how we can meet our energy demands. And so there are ways to do it. And my prediction, and this is my soapbox now, is that if that was done in an environmentally friendly way, you would convert some of the opposition into proponents of the project where we're meeting that kind of thing. And so at least that's my, if you want, my scientific two cents. But that's where I think we should go with this. Are there issues with that? Certainly. There's political issues, there's cost issues, but there's also a lot to be gained when you look at the amount of petroleum that will be coming from the Eagle Ford Shale. There should be the money to do it in an ecologically friendly way, and so that would be my scientific advice in terms of what options that we have available. So anyway, that's the brief summary. I want to just talk about real quick, great staff and team that does all the stuff at the lab and out doing all the cool work and that type of thing, and a great bunch of partners and sponsors that help us do all the work that I talked about and that kind of thing. So. Brent, I don't know where you are over here. So anyway, that's the short message from a scientific perspective, and so I'll kind of stop there.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank everyone for coming out tonight. Like I said in the beginning, this is an informative